Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
He was trying to recreate patsies in his home oven, and he's like one of the first ones to hack his home oven by disconnecting the self-cleaning cycle. He hacked off, he literally hacked off the lock on the self-cleaning cycle so that he could put the oven on self-clean
and open
the pizza at like 800 degrees. And it went viral in like 2005, 2006.
But it was like 20,000 words.
One of the smartest guys I've ever met, yet that webpage is the worst webpage I've ever seen in my life.
Pizza freaks Scott Wiener and Adam Kuban are back to talk about pizza past, present, and future in New York and elsewhere. Adam is the founding editor of the seminal food blog, Slice.com. His fellow pizza enthusiast, Scott Wiener, is the founder of Scott's Pizza Tours, the author of Viva la Pizza, The Art of the Pizza Box. So let's talk about pizza past, because we've all done some digging into pizza history, right? And I know Scott has been to Naples. I have been to Naples. I got into trouble because Naples was where the margherita pizza was invented, when a pizza maker for the Queen made a pizza with the colors of the Italian flag, green. Now, if this was a video podcast, Scott was like, we need to dispense with that myth. Talk to me.
Oh, you were just leading me into that trap.
Yeah.
Ed. Wow.
Yeah.
Skillful. Well, number one, tomato and cheese were both on pizza at least 45 years before that margherita pizza story is said to have happened.
When in 18, whatever it was.
There's explanations of what pizza was written by the French and by the British coming and visiting Naples in the 1830s and 40s.
Wow.
And they mentioned cheese and they mentioned tomato. So complete myth that the pizza margherita was the first time that the cheese pizza was invented. And I'm responsible in part for spread. You know, every year on the date that's thought of as the anniversary, I always, starting probably 9 or 10 years ago, would put up a blog post. One of the few blog posts I ever put up every year was that. And every year, if you track them, the post changes. And every year, I'd get more skeptical about that story and with new evidence about how it didn't happen.
Right. And well, what's weird is, when I went to Naples for the pizza book, because everyone's like, oh, yeah, you got to go to Naples. The best pizza in the world's in Naples. And I went with a Neapolitan, and we went to, I think, 20 pizzerias in 1 week. So it was serious. Like, we aren't messing around. You know, it's like, and I was on the back of a scooter. It was a little scary.
Wow. I got a great
in Naples,
mental picture.
Oh, my God, it's a terrible thing. But then I was like, okay, well, some of this pizza's good. A lot of it's mediocre. Often it has a pool of not even olive oil, but sunflower oil in the middle. It's kind of flaccid. So why do people tell me that the best pizza in the world is in Naples? And I got into trouble when in A Slice of Heaven, I said the best pizza in the world is made in Phoenix, Arizona at Chris Bianco's. And everyone's like, oh, come on, man. You know, Jeffrey Steingarten, who was the food critic of Vogue for a long time, called me. And, you know, once he read that, he said, you know, this is bullshit. You know, I'm going to Phoenix. You know, I told Adam Windrow I have to go to Phoenix. And then he called me from the tarmac on the way back. And he says, you're right. So is it because it is the generally considered to be the birthplace of pizza as we know it? Or are there pizzerias that I just didn't get to? I went to Domichella. I went to all the classics. I didn't go to the one that opened after I wrote the book outside Naples, which is supposed to be amazing. What's the name of that?
Pepe and Grani.
Yeah, Pepe and Grani. So let's talk about Neapolitan pizza, both in Naples and here.
Well, my first thought with your whole question of why do people say it's the best, part of it is exactly that whole origin point theory. So if that is the definition of it, it's sort of like the world's pizza cognition theory refers back to Naples. But we all know that it's been a long time since that was really the case, that we all have experienced other things, so the rules have changed. The other thing I keep thinking about, because I know, I think both of you have a similar thought on Neapolitan pizza. I happen to really like it, but it's such a defined product that the margin for error is so small that it can so easily be done poorly. So, and when it's done well, when it's done correctly, I should say, it's all the same.
So describe what you consider to be a well prepared Neapolitan pizza.
I like, let's just, well, if we're talking pizza margarita,
yeah.
I like really minimal cheese.
Okay.
Tomato, the tomato amount so that after the bake, there are a couple of spots on top of the dough that are sort of, the sauce is really thinned out so that it's almost bare and blistered. The edge, the edge, the cornicione is blistered evenly, not with dark circles, but small light speckles. And the underside is evenly charred, fully cooked all the way through, pliant, fragrant, gentle, and not soggy in the center.
Okay.
Yet not crispy.
Right. Yet not crispy. And that's the key thing. And I think that's the thing I have the hardest time with.
Yeah.
That there's no crispy edge.
Yeah. It's just that it's the kind of thing. It's like sort of like, look, if you want a car with a lot of like trunk space, you don't get a Lamborghini. You know what I mean? Yeah, like if you want crispy, don't go Neapolitan pizza shopping.
Right. What about you, Adam? What's your take on Neapolitan pizza?
I think I can recognize when it's well done or like when it's done well. Because well done is a different, beast. I can recognize when it's done well, and I appreciate it for that. But, you know, just like Scott said, and I'd never heard this before, when it's done within the correct parameters, it's all the same. I never thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense, and that's kind of why I find it a little bit more boring. The margaritas, anyway. I like toppings on pizza. I'm sorry. All these years later, even New York style, all these years later, when I first moved here, you know, I was a big proponent of you got to try a plain pizza, plain slice first to really get the feel of what it, you know. And it's probably true to some extent, but I got so bored eating plain slices and margarita, Neapolitan margaritas, that I almost can't do it again.
Yeah. And you like, I mean, you're like me. You like sausage. You love pepperoni.
Love
you
sausage.
Love meat on pizza. Yeah. Except, and I think we're all in the same place. I do not think that chicken belongs on pizza.
I'm all right with it.
I mean, you're all right with it, but it doesn't mean you actively embrace the notion.
I'm not going to – well, when on a tour, when inevitably every night somebody says, hey, where's the best buffalo chicken pizza? That's where I have to bow out and say I'm not qualified to answer the question.
I've been on the bus with you with that. Do you agree with me about the pineapple on pizza being another crime against nature, or you're okay with it?
I'm very okay with it.
Oh, man. I'm sorry, you guys. This is the end of the podcast.
Okay, thanks for having us.
It's almost like talking about Neapolitan pizza in a way. It's like because so much of the pineapple pizza you've had has been poorly made.
Right.
Because pineapple is one of those things that you most 9 out of 10 are going to throw it on out of the Dole can.
Right.
With the slime still on it. Of course you're not going to like it.
Right.
But if you take an actual pineapple, it's a real fruit. It doesn't just come in a can.
And you put it on the grill or roast it or whatever.
Yeah.
Concentrates its flavor, its sweetness.
Sweet, tangy, get some spice in there. I think it's awesome.
That's great. Have ham with it?
Oh, yeah. Fatty ham. Don't give me that deli meat ham.
You want good ham.
Yeah, but, you know, again, 9 out of 10, you go and they got the deli meat thrown over the pie. Come on.
Right. That's wrong.
The fat, you need the fat to cut up the acid from the pineapple.
Pineapple, for sure.
I don't even do ham. I do pepperoni.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Jalapeno?
Yeah, there you go.
Jalapenos. Yeah. You guys are big fans of jalapeno on pizza.
Yeah.
And hot oil. And hot honey.
Hot honey. Mm-hmm. Mm.
All these newfangled things, right? Relatively
Listen
speaking.
Listen to this geezer.
So let's talk about pizza in the U.S. And Scott and Adam, we've all talked about the origins of U.S. pizza. I think it's now acknowledged that Lombardi's opened as a grocery store.
Maybe.
Okay. Whatever it opened as, they started making pizza.
Yes.
And that was before, some people claim that people were making pizza in Trenton before.
So that conflict is, that's a place called Papa's in Trenton, or now in Robbinsville, they relocated. They started making pizza in 1912. Lombardi started in 1905. But Lombardi's was out of business for 8 years in the late 80s and early 90s. Therefore, Papa's has been running continuously. So the argument that Papa's gives is that they are older, not realizing that Lombardi's never claims to be older. They only claim to have been the first. You know what I mean? It's a lot of
We're getting
words.
In some deep scholarly pizza shit here, man.
And I mean, look, I've spent every day this past couple of weeks in the library and the municipal archive looking at like 110-year-old phone books.
I know. This is why I trust you, Scott.
Well, because I like, and the thing that why I kind of shook my head when you said about grocery store is just because I don't have any actual evidence that there was a grocery store at that space before Lombardi. The evidence that we have is a photograph of Lombardi and Totono. Taken probably in 1908.
Right.
Famous photograph of the two of them on the front steps. And there's cans in the window, which makes some people say, oh, it was a grocery store. Meanwhile, every pizzeria picture you look at before 1950 has a stack of cans in the window.
Right.
All of them do.
Right.
So.
And there's all the controversy around the fact that it's Totono that has flour on his shoes as opposed to Gennaro Lombardi. So maybe Gennaro Lombardi wasn't making pizza and Totono was.
It's entirely possible that on the day that photo was taken, Gennaro Lombardi had clean shoes and Totono didn't.
Right. Or he just had his shoes shined.
It's, you know, who knows? But the point is, we know that pizza was being made in America before Lombardi's opened in 1905.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there were bakeries making pizza. There are tons of articles that mention pizza in Boston.
Really?
A pizzeria in Boston that opened in 1907 because the owners left New York because there were too many bakeries and pizzerias in New York in 1907.
Right. So, they just weren't called pizzerias. They were bakeries making pizza like that place in
Astoria.
Yeah, in Astoria. Rose and Joe's.
Yeah, Rose and Joe's.
And of course, in other cities, you're right. Like Philadelphia, every bakery makes pizza, room temperature pizza.
Tomato pie.
Yeah. The pizza belt, as I called it in Slice of Heaven.
I love it. I love it so much. I have to say, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I still love that I'm in a room talking to you guys about this because it's your stuff that got me into this mess.
Yeah, but you've taken it to a whole other level. Actually, you both have. So the pizza belt is interesting because I called it the pizza belt in Slice of Heaven because it went from New Jersey all the way up to Boston. And it was where the Southern Italian migration took place around the turn of the 20th century because Southern Italians were in search, immigrants were in search of jobs. Where could they find jobs? Well, in the small manufacturing in Trenton and New Haven and all those manufacturing centers that are no longer manufacturing centers. And so pizzerias, I think, opened to serve the needs of the Neapolitans that settled in those cities, right? I mean,
absolutely.
And it's so weird. So when we talk about the Pizza Belt, we're talking about New Haven and Trenton and all kinds of places in New Jersey and other places in Connecticut and all the way up to Boston. And is it true, Scott, that until World War II, there wasn't much pizza outside the Pizza Belt?
I would adjust that year, and I would say really pizza had spread already outside of that area by the 1930s, that late 1930s, because of those bars and taverns that were installing ovens and making pizza on the side.
Got it. I ascribe to the myth that it was a GI coming back from World War II who had been stationed in Italy and had learned to love pizza, came back and developed a pizza oven for use, which begot the slice. You told me that is indeed not the case.
Yeah, not exactly the case. It was somebody who learned about stainless steel while in Germany during World War I.
Okay. So I was close. I was only one world war,
one war
and
away,
one country away.
Yeah, pretty tight. You're talking about Ira Nevins, who started Baker's Pride. And he started that company in 1943 in New Rochelle. But 4 years before that, there was a company called Mastro on the Bowery.
Oh, yeah, you can still get Mastro ovens.
The old ones.
Right.
Yeah, and they're no longer made. But Frank Mastro started tinkering around with that in the 30s and made it commercially available in 1939. So that's the first oven intended to be sold to pizzerias. And the oldest evidence I can find of any oven being marketed to pizzerias is the 1940 tax photo that the city of New York took of every single building in all five boroughs. The one that they took of 240 Bowery in 1940 shows the Mastro building, and there's a sign in the window that says, Forni per pizzeria, ovens for pizzeria.
Okay. First time. Okay, Scott, we now have to take Scott away. You know, that's...
Too many facts.
You looked at the tax records?
Oh, Ed, the tax records are just the beginning. Don't even, let's not go down that road yet. That's a whole other... That's a whole other thing.
I mean, so there was, it was based on a photograph in the tax records?
Yeah. Photos speak loudly.
But why did the slice start in New York?
Well, number one, there's that gas oven that we're talking about. And having an oven that's fueled by natural gas in a world that was previously populated with mostly coal-fired ovens, suddenly the oven temperature, the max oven temperature drops by 400 degrees. So now that you're in the 500, 550 degree range, the pizzas take longer to bake and they're baking up drier, but they're also, they have a longer shelf life on them because more of the water is cooked out. So they're reheatable. Pizza by the slice has to be reheated most of the time.
Right.
Unless you get a fresh pie.
Interesting.
So that oven is a big deal.
Was a slice a thing that you saw in Kansas?
No, it was really rare to see a slice pie. We had like one place in downtown Kansas City.
Isn't that weird? So what's the explanation for why slices emanate from New York and the surrounding area and the Pizza Belt, and that there are no slices still to this day? I mean, yes, there are the occasional slice places all over the country, but New York is still a slice town.
Right. Well, it's the density of New York City, and it's the layout of New York as a grid. It's a tight grid where everybody is walking. It's a pedestrian city. This is not like Los Angeles where you have to have a car, you know? So if you're stuck in your car all the time, you're not going to pull into a parking lot to get a single slice of pizza, get back in the car, and then go. No, New York, you're walking. You get out of the subway. You pass the slice joint. You grab your slice on the way home. And then when you... You know, you do the same thing every day.
It's right.
Because you can have so many of these 400-square-foot businesses that don't need a dining room, that are selling pizza just one or two slices at a time, and it works in New York. It's not the format that works in most cities.
Because of population density. But even you'd figure that it could be made to work in downtown areas where there's tons of foot traffic and lunch business to be had, and yet still... Even in Chicago, for example, there's a little bit of slice culture, but not much, right?
Yeah. And the way you just phrased it is great, because slice culture is an important way to phrase it. And maybe it has something to do with the time period that it was happening in the 50s and 60s and 70s, which is when pizza's identity really got linked directly to New York City. That direct link of New York slice with the city is hugely important. When people think of New York style pizza, they don't think of coal oven, and they don't think of all the other styles that we have in New York City. It's the indigenous pizza of New York is the slice.
Yep, it's true. So let's talk about Chicago pizza. As you know, I got in a lot of trouble for saying in Slice of Heaven that at best Chicago pizza is a good casserole. First of all, Chicago has many pizza styles, and I was saying that semi-facetiously, but I was referring to deep dish pizza. And how was that developed? What's the story with Chicago pizza?
That's another style that's got a few different stories floating around, but basically the one that everybody thinks about is that it was two guys who opened this place in 1943 with the decision that they wanted to do a sit-down restaurant with a bar component, and that this deep dish pizza was developed specifically for that restaurant. And it was called The Pizzeria in 1943. And it was semi-popular, but it was very small. So it didn't take a lot for it to be packed. But a few years later in the 50s, 1955, they decided to open up their second location down the block, which they called Due, which is when they renamed their first one Uno.
Got it. So, and Uno became, eventually became the chain.
Precisely.
And that became a thing. At the same time, there were other styles of pizza in Chicago.
Well, it's interesting. I wouldn't even say it became a thing, because if one store in 1943, two stores in 1955, and then in the 60s with Lou Malnati's, like, three, four. It
right.
takes 20 years for there to be a half dozen of these places.
That's like, not a thing, you mean?
Yeah, it's a thing because I think Chicago wanted to make it a thing. And even now you get so many Chicagoans who will defend it to the death. And then, in the next breath, they'll say, yeah, but that stuff's just for tourists. We all eat the thin crust.
I know. It's really weird.
And I don't dislike deep dish at all. I just think it's funny, the attitude situation.
Yeah, for sure. And it is all about attitude. And now, of course, Chicago, interestingly enough, is where the great Roman pizza place Pizzerium opened its first U.S. location, and that sort of farm-to-table artisanal rectangular slices, right? It's more like it's almost more like bread than pizza.
Yeah, I'm so jealous.
Yeah, me too. It's really, really good. What's his name? Gabriel
Bonci.
Yeah. I went to the one in Rome. It was really, really good. You know, I was blown away by it. So, where is pizza right now in this country and all over the world? Because pizza has become not just an obsession in New York. It's an obsession in Tokyo. It's an obsession in New Delhi. It's an obsession wherever you go, in China. What do you think is responsible for that? Adam.
The internet.
The internet.
Yeah. Yeah, the internet. The internet's responsible for a ton of stuff like that. I mean, in the first hour of this, like last week, you were asking about, you asked, like, what is it about pizza? Like, why are you guys nerds about pizza? But, like, why are people nerds about sports? We're just nerds about pizza. Other people are nerds about sports or movies. It just wasn't until, like, I think the internet came that people who were nerds about pizza could get together and talk about it and then do it in such a way that everybody else on the internet could see it.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and you're right about the internet. When I first met you, Adam, you were the first person to point out that insane, obsessive Jeff Varzano post about he was trying to replicate Pepe's?
Patsy's.
Yeah.
But he also had a thing for John's and Mount Vernon.
Right. Exactly, which you and I went to eventually.
Or is it Johnny's?
Johnny's. It's Johnny's,
yeah.
Which
I
is
was
still
holding
there.
Back. Correct.
Yeah, sorry.
You know, he's like...
I'm sorry, guys. I'll leave.
He's like spell check. He's like...
Well, actually...
Yeah, Verrazano was... he was trying to recreate Patsy's in his home oven, and he's like one of the first ones to hack his home oven by... disconnecting the
cleaning,
the self-cleaning cycle. He hacked off. He literally hacked off the lock on the self-cleaning cycle so that he could put the oven on self-clean
and
throw
open
in the
it.
Pizza at like 800 degrees. And he eventually got, like, you know, it went viral in like 2005, 2006.
But it was like 20,000 words.
Oh yeah, he had a website that had like all the places he visited. His methods for doing, like, experiment notes from...
It was crazy. Yeah.
One of the smartest guys I've ever met, yet that webpage is the worst webpage I've ever seen in my life.
Well, it's all on a single page, so it's like megabytes and megabytes, like back when...
Yes, he was not technologically savvy. But it's funny because he then opened Varzano's. In Atlanta,
yeah,
which
in
I haven't been in years, but was a really good. He opened one at the airport. I don't know if that worked out.
I've been there twice.
Really?
I loved it.
Oh, good. Oh. The internet, I think you're right. And of course, you're right because Slice, we all came to Slice and then Serious Eats to chew the fat about pizza, you know, to hang out, to get questions answered, and nothing was too geeky. You know, and it was a pretty friendly, democratic environment. You know, we prided ourselves on not being snobs, and that came from you, Adam, because that's what your point of view about Slice was and a hamburger today. And then when I started Ed Levine Eats, you know, it's one of the reasons I think you and I bonded was because you believed in passionate, discerning, and inclusive before I ever told you that that's what I wanted Serious Eats to be.
Yeah, and I probably didn't know that that was
– Right.
I didn't have it in quite those words, but yeah, that's essentially what I was doing. I don't like snobs, and I don't like I guess I don't like snob culture, and I don't like overly, like, masculine bro stuff. So, like, hamburgers, ugh, I hate that. And I hate, like, pizza, ugh. It's just, like, let's be into it, but, like, let's not be stupid about it.
Right, right.
So, like, a hamburger today, when I started as the sister site, like, I tried to avoid all, like, the just, like, dumb meathead stuff.
Chefs got into pizza, right? And chef, I guess the first chef that got into pizza was Alice Waters. She started serving that. And then Wolfgang Puck, right? Shortly after that at Spago in L.A., Alice Waters was, of course, at Chez Panisse in Berkeley, served pizza at the cafe, not at the formal restaurant. And then now it's like so many chefs have opened pizzerias. Mark Vetri in Philadelphia, Michael White, Mark Ladner, and everybody, you know, in the Batali Bastianich camp. You know, it's like Nancy Silverton in L.A. It doesn't go back because it's awesome, you know, or is it because they think they have something to add to the pizza canon?
I think it goes back to that pizza cognition theory and that everybody has that baseline, but that as a chef, you get into this territory of, you know, messing with cuisine. And I think pizza is sort of a return to simplicity. And then in a lot of ways, you're able to flex your muscles on this canvas that's very simple but not easy.
No.
And that really has a ton of variation.
When I was writing my book, I remember I did an interview with Alice Waters when I was on the beach on my cell phone. And she was like, cooking is easy. Pizza is hard, which I thought was so interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's no place to hide in pizza, you know, because it is so simple.
And it's also it's baking and it's cooking at the same time. But it's like it's not like cooking the way normal people do where you add a dash of this and you taste it and you adjust. It's you cook, you put it in the oven, and then 3 to 4 minutes later, you find out if you did it right.
In Slice of Heaven, Chris Bianco has that famous line where he says, I could teach a monkey how to make one great pizza. He said the hard part is making great pizza, and you both can speak to this, particularly Adam. The hard part is making great pizza when all the elements are changing, when the barometric pressure is changing, when the humidity is changing, when the temperature is changing, when the mozzarella is different, when the tomato, you know, it's like, is it really just a matter of an infinite number of micro adjustments?
Yeah, I would say that sounds pretty accurate. I mean, I think I remember one time we had lunch with Anthony Mangieri, and he said that there was like a window during the evening where he made as close to perfect a pizza as he would make. And he would never say he made a perfect pizza, I would think.
He's
never made a perfect pizza, but I've made close to perfect, I think is what he said.
Right. It's like, I think pizza makers are like that. It's like that line from Eric Dolphy that once you hear some music, it's over. You can never hear it again. It's like pizza's moments, you know, and you know, music is moments. And you know, we had Myra Kalman on here, the great graphic designer and writer, and she talks about life as a series of moments, and that's what she tries to capture in her drawings and in her writing. And I think pizza is really a series of moments, you know. And Anthony Mangieri, who just reopened Una Pizza Napolitana finally, which we're all thrilled about, and the pizza's awesome. Once I brought a couple of food writers when I was on the James Beard Restaurant Committee, it was a long time ago. And I brought a couple of other people on the committee, and I was like, hey, you got to try this pizza. And I walk in, I say, and it's packed, of course. I said, look, Anthony, just make us a couple of pizzas to go. And he's like, no. I was like, why? It's like, because the pizza sucks today. And if I had any integrity, I'd throw everybody out and close the place. And he would not make the pizza. He wouldn't make the pizza for me. It's like, but like, it's the restaurant critic from this and the that. I don't care.
I love that it wasn't because it wasn't good enough for those critics. It wasn't good enough
no.
for him.
No. No, it was all about his standards.
Yeah, which is the mark of like an amazing pizza maker, a partially insane person, but but like a really great pizza maker.
Yes, and he's still the same guy. We have run out of time for this episode of Special Sauce, and we haven't even gotten to the state of the slice in New York and the rest of the country and the world for that matter. And thank you both for coming on Special Sauce.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ed.
And we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.